In her new book, Emily Wallace takes us on a trip through the South to sample the roadside cuisine that has become a true marker of American culture. It's a book that lovingly takes us through the land of Nabs, Biscuitville, and Duke's Mayo. And while kneecap driving as you dine on a tray of cookout burgers is not recommended, you got to admit it's part of modern North Carolina identity. The book is called Roadsides, an illustrated companion to dining and driving in the American South. And Emily Wallace joins us now. Emily, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thanks so much.
What's going on in this book? What are you doing with this?
Well, it's an A to Z that is really sort of part encyclopedia and part travelogue. So it's broken into short entries that then have a corresponding place. A's for architecture, gives us the history of food-shaped buildings in the South. And then the featured spot is starts in my hometown of Smithfield with Hills of Snow, which is a giant snow cone-shaped building that serves, you know, snowballs.
And these become, in a way, I mean, we can talk about the food itself and some of the quirkiness of it, but it's also an insight into the history of the South and in the way we've developed, particularly in the post-World War II era, right?
Right. I really wanted it to be not just a guide to the best places and where to find, you know, food at the best. There's, in fact, a place called Cromer's Peanuts in Columbia, South Carolina, that they market themselves as the guaranteed worst in town. But just sort of a why we have these places, you know, why do we have food-shaped buildings? What's the history behind a roadside stand? That sort of thing.
When did our food-shaped buildings begin? Is that dated back to the start of the highway system?
Yeah, just really it's a way to capture people's attention and draw them off the road.
You also, let's start with the case. Well, let's talk about Nabs and Nackets, for instance. That history, fascinating stuff.
Oh, yeah. So in the letter N in the book is for Nacket, which is one of my new favorite words, and is the sort of stands for light fare. Convenient foods. To me, the best example is the Nab cracker. It's the bright orange sandwich crackers with peanut butter spread. I can't remember going on a road trip in North Carolina or beyond without a Nab. Mm-hmm. My father was a traveling salesman. He sold farm equipment to different dealerships. And, you know, you open the console and there was always a Nab, you know, pack of Nabs there, which was
and by the way, you never get the crumbs out of the back of your car.
You don't.
You never get
them
out.
It's a permanent dusting.
Have a half-life of 7 million years. But it's also, I mean, it's part nostalgia, but the history, too, because it's kind of like who started putting peanut butter crackers, you know, in cellophane to sell them ready-made, right?
Yeah. The Nabisco Company actually began, and that's where NAB gets its name. It's short for Nabisco. And it wasn't just the bright orange crackers. It was all their sort of snack line, Oreos, Lorna Doone cookies. And they sold them in these sort of primitive vending machines called Nab Diners. And then in North Carolina, we had Philip Lance, who created the Lance Company. His version was called the Toast Chi Cracker, or still is. But more commonly, it's just known as the Nab.
Lance's Snacks, Biscuitville, Hardee's, Pepsi actually got a start here, though it did have to collapse and come back in another form. Well, talk about Biscuitville and the rise of Biscuitville here in North Carolina.
Biscuitville, it actually began as Pizzaville. And Maurice Jennings, who is the founder, had this idea. He writes in his memoir that he was driving to the Chapel Hill Pizzaville location, and he thought, we could move the salad bar that we have at night and turn it into a jam and jelly bar in the morning. And we're already making this product with flour and water.
Because he's only doing lunch trade, right?
Right.
He's thinking, hey, I'm missing the breakfast.
Right,
trade.
So then switched it for biscuits, and actually it took off so much that they changed all of their, I think by 1975, that was the first Biscuitville, I think, in Danville, Virginia, and then they all kind of became Biscuitvilles. Pizza went to the wayside.
Pizzaville. So that I think that name and domain is still available. If you want to open a Pizzaville, have at it. Duke's Mayonnaise, for those who live in North Carolina, and particularly in the Triangle, you probably think it has to do with Duke University, but uh-uh.
That's Eugenia Duke. She was a really smart entrepreneur in Greenville, South Carolina. She began by making Duke's sandwiches, pimento cheese, chicken salad, egg salad, and she took these sandwiches to army-run canteens, to lunch counters throughout Greenville, and they became so popular she eventually started bottling the mayonnaise itself and sort of selling it and distributing it and sold the company to the C.F. Sauer Company in Richmond. And it's a huge entity.
Yeah, and it's also one of the interesting stories in this is that while you have a kind of a traditional gendered role,
exactly,
women making sandwiches, you also have women breaking through those roles and becoming entrepreneurs and very wealthy business people.
Right. I mean, she started a successful business before she even had the right to vote. And that was the case of a number of women who, like you said, took these sort of traditional products and built these hugely successful businesses.
You went out to Ocracoke and discovered a roadside stand called Eduardo's Tacos. People there haven't discovered that, they know. But for those of us who haven't been there recently, Eduardo's Tacos, which puts local catches in a tortilla.
Right.
Nice.
Eduardo's, I write about in the context of stands, the sort of impermanent structures that you often see by the side of the road. And they're cheaper. They usually don't require as much capital to get started as a brick-and-mortar spot, which is important in a place like Ocracoke, which is mostly designated as National Seashore.
Right.
Rent is expensive. And Eduardo Chavez started this business in a metal trailer, I think in 2012. And it's really the story of a sort of movable structure becoming a permanent fixture in the community.
Very cool. I discovered boiled peanuts on the roadside as I traveled through the South. And for me, a great discovery.
Mm-hmm.
The rest of my family doesn't agree. Well, I want to take a dive into North Carolina's taco culture right now. We talked about Eduardo's Tacos in Ocracoke. But to do this in a bigger way, I want to bring Dan Margulies into the conversation, a professor of history at Virginia Wesleyan University, the author of A Preliminary Taxonomy on the Blue Ridge Taco, part of a collection, The Food We Eat and the Stories We Tell. Dan, welcome to The State of Things.
Thanks a lot. Nice to be here.
Your work is taking a look at the way Latin American culture has now become definitely a part of Southern culture.
Yeah, I think it's only a very static view of the South if you don't also include the very large Latino population in the Southeast.
Now, talk about that. I mean, particularly in Asheville or up in the mountains, it's a fascinating story about the ways in which the culture has really embraced and now identified with much of the cuisine of Latin America.
Yeah, I think it's really should be considered a Southern foodway now instead of just a migratory one. I think that the descriptions haven't really followed the reality. I mean, it's 25 years old at least, so it's really well established at this point.
Well, you talk about, Harmony, North Carolina, for instance, an important place for bluegrass, but it's also become an epicenter for Mexican food and music.
Yeah, that's a special kind of Southern note. It's a really important musical one for old-time music, for the Fiddler's Grove and Union Grove Festival, and so now there's a very large, really monthly rodeo called the Harpeo. It has 10 or 12 hours of music, bandas and norteño bandas, and people dancing and riding bulls, eating tacos.
How has it been embraced? Is there resistance at first? I mean, what's the process by which this becomes part of the culture? Is there some resistance at first?
There would probably be local resistance, but I think people are always seeking out good food. So, I mean, if you go to, Emily mentioned, the roadside stands and taco trucks. I mean, those are places for cheap and easy food, so you'll find all sorts of people at them.
And it tends to start out that way. I mean, 'twas ever thus, even with immigration into the United States in the early 1900s. I mean, people were from their own cultures were working out of trucks and out of roadside stands and, and carts, providing the food that, Italian and Polish and Irish immigrants might want. And soon enough, the rest of the population said, hey, this stuff's pretty good.
Yeah, working class food tends to find its market and good food.
Is it the same problem? And obviously immigration is an important part of this. How have the demographics changed in the places that you were looking?
Oh, well, in the 90s in North Carolina, there were 1,000% growth, and across the Southeast, it was pretty common. So in particularly Georgia, Tennessee, North Carolina, South Carolina, parts of Virginia, the growth has been really exponential since the 90s, and it's kind of leveled off a little bit in the 2000s, but that's just because the numbers are still so high. So it's a very substantial population.
Emily Wallace, the author of Roadsides, what are you finding in terms of that kind of integration now in these kind of traditional roadside, these places that we come to know and billboards that we've come to recognize on our trip through the South?
Integration.
And immigration and the ways in which new foods are making their way into the culture and the kinds of places that you looked at.
Yeah, I mean, Ocracoke kind of going back there, it's a place that in the span of a decade, I think the Latino population grew from 2 to 20% and is now over that. And that's a huge increase for any place, but especially an island that's permanent, you know, year-round population is less than 1,000 people.
Dan Margulies, you give the example of in the ways in which we've come to think about food as either, you know, quintessentially American or somehow, you know, part of the melting pot. The taco al pastor is something that folks think of as distinctly Mexican, but you disabuse us of this.
Yeah, I'm not the one who discovered it, but it is news to a lot of people that really it's a Lebanese food that came to Mexico and was, lamb shawarma served on flatbread. And then eventually it kind of turned into pork and then became really the ubiquitous taco. And that's actually the one, I mean, the way I personally test a taqueria or a taco truck is the al pastor, just to see if they're doing it right. And from there you can delve into others.
Well, let's talk about this doing it right thing, because you do push back against this notion of authentic food in your book, right?
Yeah, you know, it's a complicated concept, so I would say that I don't seek the authentic, and at the same time I do. So, you know, I have it both ways as an academic. But, I mean, there is a right way to do a taco, in my estimation, which I can describe if you want.
Well, please do. It's lunchtime.
I would say two corn tortillas, and then the meat, and then cilantro and onion as per taste, and then really sliced radishes and a roasted jalapeno.
The two tortillas has always been curious to me, because I've always thought to myself, why not just make a thicker tortilla? And then you could just put one on there.
That's a good, a lot of homemade tortillas are pretty thick, but yeah. The real standard is to have two thin tortillas, because it holds everything structurally sound. And one tortilla, even a thicker one, they tend to crack. They don't tend to have that structural integrity of the two.
I think it's the way they meet the tooth. You need that gap between the two. Emily Wallace, what about sort of Creole culture along the way too? Things that we think of now as American that very definitely came to us from somewhere else.
Yeah, traveled extensively through Louisiana and looked at a lot of crawfish places. One of my favorites though was a crawfish shack in Atlanta off Buford Highway, and looking at sort of an intersection of Vietnamese culture, sort of Cajun Creole, with a crawfish boil that also has lemongrass and sort of these other notes.
Great stuff. Emily Wallace is the author of Roadsides, an illustrated companion to Dining and Driving in the American South. She's going to be reading at Scuppernong Books in Greensboro on Thursday at 7, and signed copies at Parker and Otis in Durham Saturday at 2 o'clock. Emily, thank you so much for being
with
us.
Thank you.
Dan Margulies is a professor of history at Virginia Wesleyan University and authored A Preliminary Taxonomy on the Blue Ridge Taco. It's in the collection The Food We Eat and the Stories We Tell. Dan, thanks so much.
Thanks a lot.
Coming up on The State of Things, Alex Grant returns to poetry after a 7-year hiatus. We'll see how his stuff sounds in just a moment. Stay tuned.